I have a number of things to discuss this morning. I'm just not precisely sure in what order we're going to do it, but I better decide very, very quickly. The topic is going to be Hanukkah, and it's also going to be the relationship between Parashat HaShavuah, which is Parashat Vayeshev, and Hanukkah. And this is one of those years, or about 10 or 11 of them in each century, where there are two Shabtot Hanukkah, both Parashat Vayeshev and Parashat Miketz, where Hanukkah begins on Shabbos and it ends on Shabbos. By the way, most of you are residents of Yerushalayim. We light candles 15 minutes later on both of these Fridays. Usually when the siren goes off, or the time for candle lighting that is in the calendar is usually 40 minutes before sunset, but on Erev Shabbos Chanukah, of which, as we say, there are two, we delay candle lighting of Shabbos for 15 minutes, and 15 minutes after the prescribed time we light Chanukah candles, and immediately afterwards Shabbos candles, and then we go to shul for mincha. Some people have a custom to daven mincha before candle lighting, but I think most of us daven mincha after. All right, you know, that's all. Just thought I'd bring that to your attention. That's all. It's a little different over here. It's a little different. All right, I'm not going to start with Parashat Vayeshev. I just made the decision. I'm going to begin with number 4 on our sheet, which looks like a bit of a long selection from the Mesilat Yesharim, but it's not that formidable, and it's a very powerful piece. We're going to read. Let's just follow me. There may be some points at which I'll stop reading and just talk a little bit. The Mesilat Yesharim, which of course is the classic Musar text of all that was written by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Litzato. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Litzato, Mesilat Yesharim, in the 3rd chapter, he says, as a general rule, a person has to weigh and assess his life daily. The way in which a person who is in business makes an assessment and a calculation of what's going on in his business daily. A fellow who's not going to look after his business or have his accountants make sure that they're going to look after it is going to find himself one of these days either at the threshold of bankruptcy or absolutely bankrupt. There are certain things you just can't let them slide. So he says this is true with a person's life. We have to study ourselves. Are we doing the right thing? Are we doing wrong things? Are there things that we can correct? Well, what's going on with our lives? Life is not hefker. Every day is extremely valuable. And it doesn't come back. It doesn't come back. So make good use of it. So he says, Klal Hadavar, number 4, the rule is, Yeh ha'adam ma'ayeno ma'asav kulam. A person should look into all of his deeds, umafakeach al kol derachav, and he should investigate all of his ways. He should not permit that there exists by him a habit that's bad, or a character trait that's bad. Certainly shouldn't have a sin or a crime that a person commits. I see that it's necessary for a person to be careful and weigh his ways every day, like big businessmen. They're always weighing and measuring their business so that things don't go wrong. You have to set aside time and an hour for it. It's not the kind of calculation that you make happenstance, just you have a few minutes free, okay, let's see what's going on with life. It's something that has to become a very basic and fundamental part of one's daily existence. It has to be done carefully, there has to be a time set aside for it, It's an extremely important and significant part of a human being's day. The Chachamim Zichronon Lebracha Horunu, our wise men taught us, Beferush Tzoruch HaChesben Hazeh, they clearly told us that this Cheshben, this calculation is necessary, and they told us Al Kain, and he brings the Pasuk Al Kain, Yomru HaMoshlim Bo Ucheshbon, come and make Cheshbono Shel Olam. He's going to go on in this piece to say, you have to make the Cheshben, and you also have to be certain that you're looking at things clearly, and there isn't anything that's blinding you. Because in many respects, we're not necessarily objective. There are all sorts of seductions in the world that blind our eyes, and we can't always see things clearly. All right? In the next paragraph, that is what our rabbis of blessed memory said, Toshet Choshech V'yihi Laila. He makes darkness and there is night. Zeho Olam Hazeh Shedomela Laila. What is darkness? This world is similar to night. V'hovein, and understand, Kamo Niflo HaMamar HaAmiti Hazeh. How amazing, how incredible is this statement of our rabbis, that there is darkness in this world. Somebody was going to spend the time to think deeply about it. And here, this is what we have to get to. Sisi Sherm says, the darkness of night can cause one of two kinds of blindness. And he's going to describe the two possible mistakes that the darkness can create. And he says the following. The darkness of night can cause one of two errors for man. Darkness covers one's eyes in such a way that he doesn't know. He doesn't see. No, there may very well be a pit. Something that's in his way, but he doesn't see it. If he keeps walking, Jonathan, I don't mind if they see you on TV. You're okay, Jonathan. Well, he has to move my car. This is very important. Now, the dark can cause one simply not to see. There may be something on the floor. There may be a step that's broken. There may be a pit, you know. And you know what happens when there's a pit? There can be a pit fall, right? But you don't see. You just don't see. He doesn't see what's in front of him. The darkness may cause the mistake of he sees something in front of him, but he can't tell, is it a pole? Is it a tree? Is it a human being? There's a blurred vision. It's dark. You can't tell what's there. Or it causes him to make a mistake. A pole looks like a man. A man looks like a pole. Kain chomriyutso, he goes on to say that the physical world is blinding to the intellect, to the mind, to the Yetzer Tov. All of those seductions out there, Kain, so too it is with chomriyut v'gashmiyut, the physical world, hinehu choshech halaylo le'ein asechel, is darkness and night to the eye of intellect, the mind. The Gadol lo shtei toyot, and it causes two mistakes. Eino maniach lo shiyireh ha-michsholot shebedarkei ha-olam, doesn't let him see the stumbling blocks that are on the road map of the world. V'nimtzeim ha-ptayim holchim la-vetach, fools who just walk with absolute confidence along a particular road, the noflim, they fall, they get lost, they didn't even know what they were walking into. They weren't even afraid of anything, because they don't see. So they don't know that the danger lurks out there. That's what the Pasuk says. Derech rishoyim kafel, the way of the evil is like darkness. Lo yodu b'meyikah shelu, they don't know. They don't know what they're going to stumble upon or over. They just don't know. The Omer, another pasuk says, Orum, the clever person saw the evil before him. Ra'ah, he saw it. V'nister, and he hid. Uptayim avru v'nenoshu. What is it? Fools tread where angels. All right, now will somebody, one person, Queenie?
Fools rush
in where angels fear to tread. Okay. The fool doesn't see, so he keeps going. Nothing stops him. The Omer, there's another pasuk he brings, Uchsil mit'aber u'boteach. The fool keeps going with absolute confidence that the path he is on, this is right, this is the derech, and that's it. Kilibam barilahem kulam, because their heart is like a big hole, the noflim terem yedume amikshol klav, they fall before they even know that there was any problem there. It's all over. Hataut hasheni. The second mistake that darkness causes, and he says this is the worst of the two, much, much worse. V'hu kasha min rishon, more difficult than the first. Hu shemater diatam, their vision is so blurred and mistaken, ad sheroim hara ki'ilu hu mamash tov, they see that which is bad as really good, v'atov ki'ilu hu ra, and that which is good, they see it as bad. They don't see correctly intellectually. Intellectually, they have arrived at a decision that something is, that's bad, they see it as real good. And something that's good, that's terrible. Terrible, what are you talking about? Shabbos is not going to stand in the way of our shopping. Shop till you drop on Shabbos. Why only drop during the week? And the Chol Shabbos is really good for the neshama. They can see that which is ra, and they turn it into tov. They turn it into tov. Religion, of course. God, this is the worst thing that ever happened to this country. We have to keep the religious down over there, understand? The settlers are the worst. This has nothing to do with politics. It's just I can't think of any better examples. They are the... all the evil in this country is because of them. It's unbelievable. What's Tov? What has always been Tov by Jews for 3,500 years, all of a sudden has turned into Ra. So you know what we're dealing with? In the first case, we're dealing with somebody who simply doesn't see. He doesn't know. You have to bring it to his attention. If you bring it to his attention, if all of a sudden he sees the road ahead of him, and he discerns that there are all sorts of stumbling blocks, then he'll wake up and he'll know what to do. He's going to watch himself. By the second one, it's not so much that he doesn't see. He sees too much. He thinks he sees too much. He knows. And he has already created a philosophy out of it. He doesn't see himself as blind. He has turned whatever he believes in into a philosophy. Oh, is it difficult to talk somebody out of that? To undo that kind of blindness, and the Seel Zisharim says, is very difficult. He says, what's bad becomes strengthened by them because they've talked themselves into it that this is good. If it's good, you have to keep doing it. Not enough that they're missing the ability to see the truth. and because of that they can't see Horosh and Neged Pneim, the evil that is before them. They find all sorts of proofs to the falsehood that they believe in, because this is their approach, you know. V'zoti hara hagadolah, this is the worst evil of all. When the mind has gone awry, there's a darkness in the mind. And this is the one Hamalafif Tam Umidvi Atam El Be'er Shechet that brings them down to the very depths. And he brings a classic pasuk in Yeshayahu. Hashmein leiv ha'om azeh v'oznov ha'chbeid ve'inov hoshah. This people, their hearts have become fat and heavy. Their ears are heavy and their eyes have been turned away, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their heart and feel the truth. Two mistakes darkness brings. One mistake, I don't see what's there. But what happens if I would know what's there? And I don't watch myself. The second is the intellectual blindness, where I know the truth. And by the way, it's so difficult to talk somebody out of the second blindness. Last night I gave up in 2 minutes. I was minding my own business at a wedding. I was mamish minding my own business. You know I always do that. And somebody comes over to me, mamish out of the clear blue sky, somebody comes walking over to me and says, who's better, Sharon or Bibi? Now, I tell you, I said hello to this fellow, but I didn't say anything. If I could vote, who would I vote for? So I told him I can't vote for Sharon, because Sharon has said that he's behind the establishment of a Palestinian state. So he's a liar. That was not the policy of the Likud. That's not what he promised us before he went into office. I can't deal with people who are liars on a matter of such great significance. It's not a question of whether there'll be bigger taxes or lower taxes, or whether you can park on Keren Kayemet or you can't park on Keren Kayemet. That's not the question. It's a serious question. And a person who lies and doesn't see that the Palestinian state is a tragedy, all he has to do is look at the buses. See the back of the buses? Well, start looking at the back of the buses. There's a big word, Asson. Asson is tragedy. And it's saying that a Palestinian state is a tragedy for the Jewish people. We know. I didn't need the buses. All right. So he says, so Bibi's better? I said, listen, Bibi is opposed to a Palestinian state. That's okay for me. But he, okay, don't get into my conversation over here. Do me a favor. All right. I'm in the middle of a conversation. Okay. Right. I just want to give you an example, Amalia. So he says, what are you talking about? Bibi is opposed to a state? He's a liar. Okay, that's what he tells me. So I said, but Sharon, we know, is a liar, because he lied already to us. Bibi may or may not be a liar. I'm only a liar. So, right, okay. Now, I think that that any intelligent person, that there's a difference between somebody who is, in Hebrew, as they say, is a liar in Kabbalot. In other words, he's clearly, he has gone against his whole party and against all the times, and somebody who has the potential to be a liar. Right? Because a politician has to be elected first before he can become a real liar. Anyway, this fellow keeps telling me, no. If you vote, you have to vote for Sharon. So I told him, first of all, leave me alone. I'm not voting for anybody. But it was clear there is nothing in the world that I would say that would make any difference whatsoever. For whatever reason it is, he came to talk to me, and I didn't ask him. And he clearly has his opinion, and when somebody has an opinion that they think they funk it out well, and it's so wise, it's very, very difficult to get them changed. You can see disaster as the result of decisions that were taken,
And if you think everybody's eyes are opened up, no, they're not opened up. Because the blindness, the intellectual blindness that comes as a result of the fact that a person sees something which is inherently bad and evil as good, can't talk him out of it. It's very difficult to talk him out of it. With this Mesilat Yesharim, I wanted to go one step further. There is the famous Machloket, and I think you heard about it in the previous year, the Machloket between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel with regard to Hanukkah. Beit Shammai says that on the first night you light 8 candles, and then it goes down night by night, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and the final night of Hanukkah, 1. That's Beit Shammai. Beit Hillel say, Mosif v'holech. You keep adding. The first night, 1, then 2, 3, as we do. So I wanted to say that there is a great deal of truth in both of these positions. Beit Shammai is talking about the first blindness. What's the first blindness? It's dark. A person can't see what's ahead of him. All of a sudden there's a burst of light and the person sees. There are all sorts of obstacles in his way. Once he sees that, and now it's been brought to his attention, he's going to be very cautious as he continues to travel. The light can diminish day by day, but he knows already the evil that's before him. He knows that there are all sorts of obstacles in the way that he has to overcome. Beit Hillel is talking about the intellectual blindness. The one whose blindness has already created a philosophy of life, as he calls it, a shita, that good is evil and evil is good. Boy, that's going to be a very difficult. A burst of light is not going to help at all. You know what you're going to need? A process of education. Ki ner mitzvah v'torah or the chokhmah of ner and menorah. You know what you're going to need? The first night, 1 candle. Can't teach anybody too much. First you have to spend some time with him and think, listen, is Sharon really so good? Or maybe he has problems. By the second night, when there's a second candle, then you say, is BP all that bad? He did sell a lot of furniture for Rim when he was a furniture salesman, right? By the third night already, you know, 3 candles and maybe you're getting your way. The person who suffers from the second blindness, the intellectual blindness, has to be taken by the hand through a process of re-education. A burst of light is not going to help. What you're going to need is taken by the hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then as I was thinking about this, this was a few years ago, I came across a pasuk in Yeshayahu. We were learning Yeshayahu then. Number 5. Unbelievable. I read the pasuk. And my eyes lit up as I read the pasuk. Yeshayahu says the following, Ha'om ha'olchim b'choshech, the people who are going in darkness, Ro'u or gadol, saw a great burst of light. Yoshvei be'eretz tzalmavet, those who were settled in, living in the land, in the shadow of death, or noga aleihem, light began to shine upon them. There are 2 parts to the pasuk, and every word is amazing in these 2 parts of the pasuk. The first part of the pasuk is obviously talking about a tremendous burst of light all in one single moment. Ha'om ha'olchim b'choshech, people are going in darkness, ro'u or gadol, great light. Who is this referring to? This is referring to the people, the masses of people. They may have thought at one point that the road upon which we're traveling is good, and then comes the burst of light and they see all of the pitfalls that are there in front of them. But then there are others who are yoshnei be'edetz tzomavet. There are those who have settled in to a never-never land that has shades of light and darkness. These are the people already, the great intellects. Not the Om. The Om never knows what to do. Only the brilliant intellectuals know what to do. Yoshvei Be'eretz Shalmavet or Noga Alehim. Or Noga Alehim means that the light begins to shine. Kima Kima, little by little, because they have to be taken through a process of re-education, and that's extremely difficult. So the Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are each referring to a different form of blindness, a different kind of darkness that is described by the Simat Yishayahu. And the Chanukah, therefore, is, I imagine, the halacha, of course, is that, like Beit Hillel, and we do like Beit Hillel, because as the Mesirat Yisharim said, the intellectual blindness, the blindness that has already created a whole approach and a whole philosophy of life, is infinitely more dangerous, more powerful, and therefore what's necessary is the re-education of a people. All right. Step number two. That's part one. Step number two. What's the relationship between Chanukah and Parashat Vayeshev? Parashat Vayeshev. So in our first section, what we've talked about is the importance of the ability to see things clearly. But what do we have to see? What's there to see? So the Pasuk says, when Yosef came toward his brothers, the tragedy of Yosef and his brothers begins in Parashat Vayeshev. His father sends him out to go see how his brothers are tending the sheep. He comes to Shechem and he doesn't find them. And he's going through the field, he's wandering through the field, he can't find his brothers. Vayimtzaehu ish, and a man found him. And the man finds him and asks him, what are you looking for? And he says, et achai anochi levakesh, I seek my brothers. So Rashi, of course, tells us that this was a malach, an angel who came because Yosef has a meeting with destiny. He has to get to his brothers. That's going to begin the process of the Jewish people going down to Egypt. And there's and therefore, here it would seem as though the plan has gone all wrong. He's supposed to meet his brothers in Shechem. He goes there, the brothers aren't there. The fact is that Yosef could very well have turned around and said, gone home and told his father, I looked for them, they weren't there. And what's fascinating is the pasuk says, "Vayimtzaehu ish," a man found him. What do you mean a man found him? The pasuk should have said, Yosef found a man walking through the field. Because Yosef is the one that's lost. Oh, no. That's how our rabbis know that this is a malach. There was a man out there who was sent to find him. There's an amazing statement by the Ramban. The Ramban says that this story comes to teach us ki hachavitzut sheker v'agzeira emet. Whatever man does may not make a difference. Because if there's a gzeira, if the Rebbe Hashem has decided how history is supposed to play itself out, that's exactly what's going to happen. And if there are moments in which the Rebbe Hashem has to bring down an angel for a mid-course correction to get everything back on track, that's exactly what he does. They come to his brother, they see him coming, there are those who want to kill him. Finally, Reuven says, let's throw him into the pit. And it says, Vayikachu, they took him, number one, Vayashlichu oto havorah, and they threw him into the pit, Vahavor reik, ein bo mayim, and the bor, the pit, was empty, there was no water in it. Number two is really the Gemara, famous Gemara Masechet Shabbat. The Gemara Masechet Shabbat is that which talks about the Hanukkah candles that we have to light. Let's read the English. Another law
regarding the placement of the Hanukkah lights, because the first paragraph is the Gemara. Omar Rav Kahana said that Rav Nosson Bar Minyume, in the name of Rabbi Tanchum, said the following. Ner shel Chanukah shehinicho lamala me'es ma'amo psula kesuka ukemavul. A ner Chanukah that you put 20 cubits high, that's about 40 feet, be'erech approximately, if it's that far up, it's possible, it's not good. Kesuka ukemavui. Like sukkah, the halacha by sukkah is, if the schach is 20 cubits from the floor of the sukkah, you have a high-rise sukkah, then you know what you have? You have a puzzle sukkah. And there's another halacha in Shulchan Aruch, the halacha of mavui. Mavui is when there is a courtyard that leads out into public domain. In order to carry within that courtyard that leads out to the street, you need a korah, a beam at the entrance to that mavui, so that turns the mavui into a real reshut hayochid, private domain. Because it sort of is a reminder that this is where private property ends and the street begins. And you know, where there's no eruv, you're not allowed to carry from private domain into public domain. So the halacha by Chanukah is, ner Chanukah that you place more than 20 amma high is possible, just as a sukkah would be possible and a mavui would be possible. In both of those cases, of course, it is because the Gemara says, lo shota ba'ina, the eye doesn't see it. Now Chanukah, the whole purpose is pirsumei niso, so that the miracle should be known. Now, if you live in a high-rise apartment, don't get worried about it. Don't get worried about it. Because for all intents and purposes, we light the Chanukah candles now for the well-being, so that the people inside should see. It's not for the people in the street to see. So as long as it's now for the people inside to see, so it makes no difference. You can be on the 20th floor, it makes no difference. Of all the strange things, immediately after this halacha of Ner Chanukah, the same rabbi, the Omar Rav Kahana, and Rav Kahana, the same Rav Kahana, said in the name of Rav Nosson Bar Minyume, in the name of Rav Tanchum, my dechtiv, you know what this second statement is? What's meant when the pasuk says, v'habor reik, the bor, the pit is empty? Ein bomayim, it has no water. So the Gemara asks, Mimash Mishanema, if it says Habor Reik, the pit is empty, Ein Yodea, don't I know Shein bomayim, that it doesn't have any water? No, what would have happened if the Pasuk would simply have said the bor, the pit is empty? I would have known there's nothing in it. Why does it have to add Ein bomayim? So it goes on to tell us, it's not completely empty. It's empty of water. Avol nechoshim v'akrabim yesbo, there are snakes and scorpions in that pit. Snakes and scorpions in that pit. So there's a tremendous amount of literature that has been written over the centuries about what's the relationship between these two statements. The statement about Ner Chanukah and the statement about the pit. So one of the simple answers is, and that's the Torah to me, but down below that Ramban says it, they didn't know that there were snakes and scorpions because the pit was deeper than 20 amma. If they want to save Yosef, you don't save Yosef by throwing him into a pit with snakes and scorpions. The Gemara says that if a person is thrown into a pit of snakes and scorpions, you can testify that he's dead and his wife can go ahead and marry again. She's not an aguna. Because it's so certain that a person is going to die in a pit of snakes and scorpions. So how did they throw him into that bar? Not only they threw him into the bar, it was Reuven who did it. And the Pasuk says about him, Vayishma Ruvain, Ruvain heard, Vayatzilehu miyadam, he saved Yosef from the hands of his brothers. How do you save Yosef from the hands of his brothers when you throw him into a pit of snakes and scorpions? How does that work? One of the approaches that has been taken through the centuries, so the first approach, of course, is the simplest one, which says that they didn't know. They didn't know because it was so deep that they didn't know. Why shouldn't they have been careful about it? I mean, you know, how do you just take the chance of throwing him into a deep pit like that where there may be snakes and scorpions? There are those who say that what really took place over here was a struggle between Reuven and Yosef. Both of them want to save, between Reuven and Yehuda. Both of them want to save Yosef from the brothers. Both of them want to save. Reuven's idea is, let's put him into the pit. And they do know that there are snakes and scorpions there. And he do that rather than follow the advice of or the counsel of Yehuda. Yehuda says, let's sell him down to Egypt. This is the machloket between the two. What is the machloket between the two? They both know that Yosef is a tzaddik, and that the Rebbeinu Shlom is going to save him. Reuven says, if it's a question of putting him in physical danger or in spiritual danger, putting him into the pit or sending him to Egypt. In the pit, the danger is physical. Mitzrayim, the danger is spiritual. You don't remain a frumagid in Mitzrayim. It is the seat of all evil. So Reuven says, you can't take a chance with Yosef's neshama, but with his body, don't worry, the Rebbeinu Shlom will take care of him. Listen, Daniel went into the lion's den and he emerged. And Yehuda says, no. Yehuda says, no. Can't put him into a pit with snakes and scorpions. But you can send him to Mitzrayim. You know what Yehuda is really saying? That Yosef is tzaddik enough that he will survive Mitzrayim. Was Yehuda right?
Yes.
He certainly was.
Yes.
But about whom does Torah testify that he wanted to save him? Torah doesn't say about Yehuda that he wanted to save him. Torah says about Reuven that he wanted to save him. Because if one is faced with one of the two possibilities, either physical harm, serious physical harm, or spiritual harm, one should choose the first rather than the latter. There's a great deal, this is classic drush over the centuries. Of course, there's a great deal that can be done with this. Somebody who wrote a letter recently that you're not allowed to tell people to come to Eretz Yisrael. From America, you can't tell people, what right do we have to encourage people to come on Aliyah when there's great physical danger over here? Ah, but wait a minute, there may be physical danger here, but there is extreme spiritual danger in the United States of America. One is Reuven, and one is Yehuda. One is the pit, and there are snakes and scorpions here, there's no question about it. And there's a spiritual danger there, so which is to be chosen over here.
Alright, so there's a very fascinating essay from Rav Kook about Yosef's pit.
I'll take you a little journey through one of the great essays of Rav Kook. Rav Kook says the following. There are two kinds of objects or things, like, I don't like the word thing, but I don't have a better word, you know. There are two kinds of situations. Oh, that's not a bad word. Two kinds of situations that can pose danger. One is something where, in and of itself, inherently, by its very nature, it's not dangerous. The danger is the result of how man treats this object, thing, or
what else did I call it?
His situation. Okay. The example, of course, that he gives is a pit, a well with water, is inherently very beneficial to man. If you're not going to watch where you're walking, and you're not going to deal with it with the caution that is required, it can become dangerous, life-threatening. We can use the example of a car. A car is a very convenient mode of travel. But what happens if you don't treat it with caution? You're not careful. It can become a terribly destructive thing. So what do you do with a pit that has water? Do you get rid of all pits with water? We need pits with water. You get rid of all cars? No, you don't get rid of all cars. But what you have to do is start teaching people, or continue the process of educating people, that these are objects, situations, that have potential for danger. If you are careful with it, it brings great blessing and makes things much easier. If you don't, it's problematic. There's a second kind of situation. Yes?
Well, the classic example is fire.
Good example. Fire is a good example. Can be very dangerous and can be most beneficial. Right? Fire was created by God. By the way, man was also created by God. And man can also be very dangerous. There are men who are snakes and scorpions. Okay? There's a second possibility, where the object or the situation in itself is not beneficial, but it's not harmful. It's neither one of the two. It's paratha. But it has the potential to be good. That potential to be good, for example, a pit that doesn't have water. A pit that doesn't have water. A pit that doesn't have water. You can fill it with water. You can make something. I don't know. Somebody, some kohen will come make a high rise over it. I don't know what they do. There's a lot of things you can do with it. So even though at this particular moment, it's not necessarily beneficial, but it could be. It has the potential to be beneficial. So you're supposed to treat it as though it has that potential. Then there are situations in the world that are absolutely fraught completely with danger, and there's nothing to do except its absolute eradication and destruction. There's no way to deal with it. And that, Rav Kook says, is a pit that has snakes and scorpions in it. There's no way that it's ever going to be beneficial. There's no way that it's ever going to be good. It's always going to be a source of grave danger. This is his introduction. His introduction to Boro Shel Yosef, the bore of Yosef. See, he says the following. There's a very long Medrash Tanchuma that says Yosef is the symbol and the representative of Jewish history. Kol ma she'ida liYosef, ida liTzion. Whatever happened to Yosef happened to Tzion. And the Medrash gives all sorts of examples, Zukum all over, that whatever happened, whatever transpired in the life of Yosef, Yosef was hated, Klal Yisrael had been hated, Yosef was thrown into pit, Jews throughout centuries were thrown into pits. There's so many different things that the Gemara says. Yosef is the symbol of the Jewish people. So therefore, when we talk about Yosef and the pit, we're not talking about simply an individual called Yosef who's in a pit. We're talking about Klal Yisrael in Tzaz. So he says, Rav Kook goes on to say the following. He takes this whole Gemara about the pit as talking about, what is the pit? The pit into which Yosef is thrown is the symbol of the beginning of exile. This is where Jewish exile from the Holy Land begins. This is the beginning of the exile. So that whatever is transpiring in and around this bar is representative of the Jewish people throughout the exile. So he says the following, that there are those who say, there are those who may live with the illusion
just as with something that has potential danger. We talked about a pit with water. We talked about a pit without water. How do you deal with those two? I begin to watch myself. In other words, my life now has to take into consideration that there is a pit there. If I just take care of myself, it will not be dangerous. It's going to be very, very beneficial. So he says there are always Jews who said to themselves that the Golus, exile in and of itself, is not really terribly dangerous. All you have to do is you have to know how to negotiate it, how to maneuver it, how to adjust to it, and how have the exile adjust to them. So he says that, you know, there are people who thought that they can always find a sense of peace and tranquility and security any place in the world. All you have to do is make sure that you don't stick out too much like a sore thumb. You have to conduct yourself very nicely. People are going to like you. You may even be able to make it up into the higher echelons of business. You may even end up owning some of the insurance companies and the media. You may even become a vice president of the United States. All sorts of things can happen. All you have to do is know how to negotiate the system and how to accommodate it and accommodate to it. And if you know how to live with your surroundings, the Golus can be a golden Medina. It can really be just what the Rebbeinu Shlomo showing Lord. And no damage and nothing really is going to happen there. It's all fine. So he says those two can easily be negotiated. You can adjust your life to the fact that there's a pit with water there. You can adjust your life to the fact that there's a pit there. You can even someday turn it into be very beneficial. He says that this bor into which Yosef is thrown and represents the beginning of exile can only be described as a pit of nechoshim da'akabim, of snakes and scorpions. Now he says, what's the symbolism of snakes and scorpions? Chazal or rabbis didn't simply create the beautiful terminology. There's something significant. He says that according to the Gemara, there's a big difference between a snake and a scorpion. I don't know too much about snakes and scorpions. But according to Chazal, a snake shoots its venom, and after it shoots its venom, it really gets exhausted and has to rebuild its stock and its store of venom. The snake is that, which is, there may be outbursts of anti-Semitism, the venom going into Jews, but then, you know, it recedes, and there'll be a period of time and peace between one outbreak of anti-Semitism and the next. Maybe you can live with that. Maybe you can live with that. Sure. I don't know why one should, but you can live with that. But he says, Chazal are telling us that there's another problem with exile. That other problem is, it's like a scorpion. Now, I've forgotten for years what the Gemara says about a scorpion. The difference between a snake and a scorpion, a snake always has to have intent to cause damage. The scorpion causes damage involuntarily. It's not a conscious decision on the part of the scorpion. It's a reflex of the tail of the scorpion kills. It's a reflex action. That's why all of those stories were about the scorpion that wanted to get to the other side of the river and asked a turtle to take him across, or the turtle said, a frog? All right, we've got to keep the story straight, you understand? A frog, so he asks the frog to take him piggyback across the river, so the frog says, well, listen, you may kill me. I promise I won't kill you. Because if I kill you, we're both going to drown. So he takes him across the river. Halfway through the river, the scorpion stings. The scorpion stings, And as the frog is dying, he says, but you promise. So he said, but I can't help it. I can't help it. The story, by the way, this famous mashal was going around when the wise men of Chelm brought Arafat Yimach Shemai to Eretz Yisrael, as Arafat is going to take them across the... we're going to take him across the river, you understand? We're going to take him to the promised land, and he's going to come across on our back, and he promises that he's not going to do anything bad, and halfway through he does his thing, and he says he can't help him. So Rav Kook says, you know what the scorpion represents? The scorpion represents the harm to the Jewish people that is inherent in the very nature of the exile. There doesn't have to be an intent. There can be no anti-Semitism. And we know, of course, there can be absolutely no anti-Semitism. And despite the fact, the atmosphere, the whole atmosphere of the Golan, is an atmosphere that is destructive to Yiddishkeit. We don't have to belabor the fact that America has been the most serious loss to Klal Yisrael in history. It's involuntary. It's not a matter of the of an intent, an anti-Semitic intent. It's just the whole atmosphere is one. Sitting last week with an elderly woman. Son lives in the United States, is marrying a non-Jewish woman. He's already, and I'm talking about somebody young, and she's devastated, like had nachas her whole life, and then all of a sudden, why? She's partially devastated. All I can do is listen. That's all I can do. I can listen and get choked up together. Involuntary. Absolutely involuntary. They work together, and you know, all you need is a few years of working together, or much less than that. It's a serious problem. So this is what Rav Kook says. Rav Kook says that the Bor of Yosef, and Yosef being in the Bor, represents the beginning of exile. And not only it represents the beginning of exile, it is the model for exile, Golus, throughout all of history. This also brings us to the next step. The next step is, that was the struggle that took place between the Hellenizers, the Hellenists, and the Hasmonaim. The Hellenists said, listen, take a look. There is a Greek culture that has such beauty and such dignity and such nobility, so intellectually stimulating. Klal Yisrael, Torah can survive side by side with Greek values. Rishkefeller will survive it. The Hasmonaim said, no. This is, Greece is a bor of nechoshim v'akrabim. That was the struggle. They said it will destroy us. Greece has to be fought until we are ultimately victorious. That's why the Gemara puts these two statements side by side. Is psula of the halacha of Ner Chanukah, and the statement that this was a bor of the choshim v'akrabim of snakes and scorpions are put side by side because the struggle of Chanukah was a struggle against the snakes and the scorpions. It was a struggle for the spirit of the Jewish people. There's another way to look at the pit of Yosef and its relationship to Chanukah. Historically, we have always suffered either from physical destruction, the Chol Dor V'Dor, Om Dimaleinu L'Chaloteinu, and every generation they rise up against us. The second, of course, is we talked about assimilation. And the third is, God forbid, the way we destroy ourselves from within.
take a look at the history of Bayit Sheni. The Rambam, we're going to see the Rambam, if we have a few minutes, we'll see the Rambam yet. The Rambam begins his description of Chanukah as saying, Bayit Sheni, during the time of the second Beth HaMikdash, there was the struggle against Greece. Do you know what that means? There are three periods of Bayit Sheni. The second Commonwealth has three periods. The first was the period of Persia and Haman. The second is Antiochus and Yavon. And the third is Rome. The first one was the threat of physical destruction of the Jewish people. Haman wanted Lahashmid, Lahara, Gulabi, Eskalai, Hudi, Minar, Batzaki, Tatanah, Biomechad. He wanted to destroy all of the Jewish people. Haman up in Ithaca left. We emerge from that strengthened. The second struggle that comes in the middle of the temple period is the struggle for the spirit of the Jewish people. And in that struggle for the spirit of the Jewish people, the Hasmonaim emerge as victorious. Greece and Greek culture are defeated. When is the Beth HaMikdash destroyed? When is it that everything collapses? Only when the third threat comes. And the third one is the inner strife and struggle between Jews themselves. We are our own worst enemies. It's the Sinat Chinam and the Sinat Achim. It began really, unfortunately, with the last generation of the Hasmonaim. The Hasmonaim were kings for 8 generations. And the last, the two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, civil war breaks out. The Memshelet Ardut Le'umit, you understand, collapses for nothing whatsoever. That's the end. That we weren't able to survive anymore. That's when Churban came. We can stand up against physical danger. And by the way, when we talk about physical and spiritual danger, we're talking about Reuven and Yehuda. That was the machlokes, Reuven and Yehuda. Reuven believed that we can survive physical a threat to our physical existence. Yehuda held that we can survive a threat to our spiritual existence. But the one thing we couldn't survive is if the struggle between Yosef and his brothers would continue on into eternity. Sefer Bereshit had to end with that problem being resolved. And that's the whole point that we're getting to when we finally come to the end of Vayechi and a family is reunited together. That's the only source of our strength. You can ask me, do I have great words of consolation, of nechama? Do I have great words of nechama? We're suffering all three. We're suffering all three at one time. We are being picked off physically. There's a profound spiritual struggle that's going on in this country. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. That I don't know, somebody told me that there were 500,000 people who came to the canyon in Kvarastapa when it was open. Is that true? 500,000 people. I can't believe it. That's not the only, there's so many other struggles going on in this country. So many other struggles that are going on. And Yovan, according to Chazal, the exile of the Greeks was called Choshev, was called darkness. And that's how the Shia started. We started talking about the darkness. The darkness that hides the pitfalls, the head, and then there's the intellectual darkness. I'm afraid that a significant number of our people haven't learned a thing in the last 9 years. Not in the last 2 years. Not in the last 2 weeks. Not in the last 2 weeks. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. We need Rachamei Shamayim. And what we need is, it's getting a little bit scary here. It's getting a little bit depressing. There's reason for great concern.
And we have to understand that Chazal, and certainly in the world of Chassidut, they tell us that every Yontif has its unique source of inspiration. The inspiration of Chanukah is the ability to see clearly. And certainly, where you said we pass from like the Hillel, and therefore it's one candle the first night and each night an additional one. There has to be a process of coming to see the light. I don't know what more we need. I really don't know what more we need. But that's really what's going to have to happen. They always say, it's the Shasenas, the Rabbis say, if there's nothing that we can personally do, we can at least pray that people should see the light. We're in a difficult situation. But then again, I always say, how many times have I said it, that the rule in modern Jewish history is expect the unexpected. The Rabbeinu Shleilam, oh boy, he has a few things up his sleeve. And when they come out, I think we will see the great light. Ha'om ha'holchim b'choshech ro'u or gadol Yishayah. What a puzzle. Ha'om ha'holchim b'choshech ro'u or gadol Yoshvei be'eretz tzamavet or nogalein. Kein yidatzel. Chanukah Sameach.